Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 o'clock in the British Isles, 10 o'clock in Paris and Berlin, 11 p.m. in Istanbul and Jerusalem, and the early hours of Friday morning for our Asian and Pacific listeners. But wherever you are on this benighted earth, we welcome you along to our Clubland Q&A. You know how this works. You can listen to us. All 7 billion people are able to listen to this show. But to ask a question, you do have to be a Mark Stein Club member. And if you're thinking, well, I've got one question I've always wanted to ask Mark Stein, but is it worth joining that club of his for? Well, probably not. Probably not. You should probably save your money and buy a Doris Day compilation album or something with your hard-earned dollars instead. But if you do have a burning desire to join our club, we've been here nearly 4 years, and I didn't think we'd be here 4 years ago. Things were in pretty rotten shape, but it's looking like we're going to make it. And if you want to join our number, you're more than welcome to. There's been a lot happening. Most of it is rubbish, as it always is, on the hamster wheel. You should always think when you get excited about, this is just my tip as a commentator on this and that over the years, you should always think, is this going to be important in 6 weeks' time? Because if it's not, it's probably not worth getting invested in, emotionally speaking. And you should give a thought to the stuff that's going to be important in 6 months' time. Nah, actually, even that isn't that important. 6 years' time, that may be. I mean, we'd all like to think about, you know, what's going to be important in 6 centuries' time, but it's not. That's not where we live. We like to focus on a lot of the big picture stuff. But I'm looking forward to your questions. And that's my way of saying, you know, there are aspects, whatever, that thing last night in America, it wasn't a State of the Union, it was just a joint address to Congress or whatever. So I'm not really too exercised by that, but you're certainly allowed to ask me a question about it. Douglas Neviera says, Mark, what do you make of Biden's aggression towards Russia? Will there be consequences? Will it hurt our competition with China? Well, I think realistically, whoever's waggling Joe Biden's sock puppet, and I should say just at the outset, you know, I bought into the theory, whatever condition Joe Biden is in, you know, sometimes he's on and sometimes they've sent him out there without fully winding up his battery or whatever. I don't believe for a moment Joe Biden is running the government. I do believe he's agreed to be the figurehead for whoever's running the government, mainly just for personal... I guess this way, you know, the thing about him is when Obama made him vice president, made him his running mate, everybody thought that was just a joke. And they thought Biden was a joke. And he was a joke as vice president. He was the guy who stood behind Obama when he announced Obamacare and whispered in his ear, this is a big effing deal. This sort of strangely unpersuasive macho braggadocio thing. And I think Biden didn't want to go down in history as Obama's joke vice president. And given that we're now in a moment where Obama's name is being taken off grade schools because he deported too many illegal immigrants, in other words, because Obama was too moderate, Biden has agreed basically to out-left Barack Obama and make himself and go down as, you know, the FDR of the 21st century. He's agreed to lend his name to that. As to the Russian business, what they're doing is they're keeping the Russia hoax going. That's why, for example, even though Roger Stone was pardoned by President Trump, Roger Stone had his life destroyed. This is by this evil FBI, evil Department of Justice. These are and I'm not interested in defending them. I don't do the Sean Hannity thing. Oh, I love FBI agents. Some of the hardest working. No, I don't care. I'd like to know how many FBI agents have ever objected to any of this Russia garbage. And I don't find that. And every time I've looked, all I hear is crickets chirping. And I'm sick of the chirping crickets. And I'd like some Republican candidate to say, yeah, the FBI and the DOJ, they're just a Bureau of Prisons who presided over the mysterious express checkout of Jeffrey Epstein. Everything that comes under the Department of Justice is corrupt. So I'd like the Department of Justice dismantled and the FBI abolished, and I'd like whatever replaces them to be less corrupt. And I'd like to hear some Republican candidates talking about that. But so Roger Stone was one of the ones they illegitimately targeted. He got pardoned by Trump, and that's pretty nice. You get pardoned, and yes, you're broke, because they've exhausted all your savings and you've had years of your life stolen from you by these dirty, filthy, rotten, corrupt pseudo-justice guys at the FBI and the DOJ. And then suddenly, the day after the inauguration, they announce that they're going after Roger Stone again for the interest on his taxes. He was broke. Basically, all his money went to lawyers fighting off this dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice. He still managed to scrape together, you know, from enough debit cards that allow you to take out whatever it is, $200 a day or whatever. He managed to find enough cash hither and yon, putting together about 37 different cards to pay his taxes, but they were late. So now he's got some interest on it. And this dirty, filthy, rotten, stinking, corrupt, evil Department of Justice that every American should be ashamed by. You should stop bleating about, the greatest constitution in the world. You're in a post-constitutional order with no equality of law. What are you going to do about that? Don't wave your constitution at me. The Constitution's dead. It's a post-constitutional order where you don't have equality before the law. So they're going after poor, broke Roger Stone for the interest on the taxes he paid. He shouldn't have paid taxes. He should have climbed into the back of my pickup and I should have thrown a tarp over him and driven him across the Canadian border, where at least the Treasury doesn't have a SWAT team to kick your door down and pump bullets in your aged wife if she's too slow getting out of bed. And a disgraceful, disgusting, I cannot tell you, well, as you might have suggested, might just hear, if you're listening in Dolby FM stereo or whatever, that I'm getting a bit carried away by it. Anyway, the reason, what that shows you is that they're keeping the whole Russia investigation garbage alive. And that's why it's, and this is how foreign policy is not about foreigners in the least. Foreigners exist only for the game being played domestically, which is to destroy the political opposition. So in other words, there's a real guy called Vladimir Putin who heads up a government of a foreign country on the other side of the earth. But he basically exists in the Orwellian sense for the alleged Biden administration, in that he is the designated villain of the day. Now, this would normally be, it's not quite the cozy tripartite setup that it is in Orwell's 1984, as you'll know if you heard my serialization of it, and if you didn't, you should have. But it is actually the same principle, that geopolitical affairs only exist as a form of domestic control. And so keeping Putin as the bad guy, when he's obviously, you know, a pipsqueak compared to Chairman Xi, is useful to Biden as a way of keeping Republicans on the back foot. And of course, out in the real world, Chairman Xi and Putin and the Mullahs all have their cozy little arrangement and do their joint military exercise, the naval exercise and all the rest of it. Because actually taking out America, ending the American moment, is what's the priority. What's the priority for them? That's the answer to that one, Douglas. Al Mann from CA, which I believe is California, says, "Hi, Ma. I didn't catch President's asterisk's screed last night. I was busy watching a recorded autopsy." I think instead of a State of the Union, we should actually have a recorded autopsy, a state of the corpse. Did he happen to mention the Durham Report? No, the Durham Report. I don't know how long it is since anybody's seen John Durham. I wouldn't be surprised to hear that he'd actually died in 2007 or something. But his report is still coming. We'll bring you an update on the Durham Report, because there are people who still believe in it. Tom Lewis writes, "Would you venture a guess on who President Kamala will select for vice pres? Susan Rice, Pete Buttigieg, what's his name? I'm not even sure that Kamala... Well, it's very difficult. It's difficult now. The thing about Biden is he's stabilized. He may be around a while longer than you think, Tom. Rachel writes, "New York City Mayor de Blasio announced today that everything in New York City would be reopening without restrictions on July the 1st. Do you believe him? Is it too late for New York? Do you think you'll ever go back to New York for any reason?" You know, I can't quite imagine it, because it's amazing what you learn you can do without. For example, you may have seen when I've done things like a full week of hosting on Fox News Primetime, when I've guest hosted for Tucker. In the old days, I used to fly in to New York. And I was known at the hotel, and they always gave me their best suite and everything, because I was such a regular fixture at that hotel. And I would like, I think I mentioned it the other day, I love doing the Jerry Lewis King of Comedy. After I've been there a couple of times, love doing the Jerry Lewis King of Comedy walk. The few blocks to Fox, you know, with taxi drivers shouting out the window, "Hey, Mark Stein, I love you on that Hannity show. Or is it Mark Levin? I don't know. I love you, man." And I'd be doing the Jerry Lewis pistol thing where you fire off the acknowledgement of the fan. And then suddenly you don't do it. You just do the show from the North Country, which I wouldn't have thought possible a couple of years ago. You could do national television from the depths of the Great North Woods, and then I think, you know, well, Broadway. I used to like taking, you know, if it was Christmas, taking the kids with me, and we'd all like go and see the shows and. Used to take him to Birdland to hear Cool. And now everything's... I don't want to go and see a Broadway show at 25% capacity. If I wanted to see a theatre that's three quarters empty, I could go to one of my shows. I'm joking. You know the size of crowd we got when we did that. I think the trick with this COVID thing, and it's very difficult... But my whole attitude to it, and really this is because I was in Tennessee earlier this week. You know, what you want to do is you want to ask yourself, how normal is your life right now? And this applies to wherever you're living on the planet. Do you have, like in Ireland, where you can't go more than 3 miles from your home, like in my deranged dominion of Canada, where because of their flop on the vaccines, the lockdowns are getting nuttier and nuttier. Everywhere else, they're being liberated because, if you like, if you're Gibraltar, I think I mentioned last time, is the first place in the world where they're at 100% vaccination. But the United Kingdom, and the guy issued, the Premier Gibraltar, as I said, I was rather touched by his little remark about the British family of nations, because in the British family of nations, Canada is a big dud at the moment. But the United Kingdom, they've got 95% herd immunity among people over 65, which is pretty spectacular. So it becomes harder and harder at that point to justify the lockdown. So my whole thing is, if you find out where it is you can lead a normal life and do everything you did before lockdown. And I'll be very surprised if de Blasio's New York is in that condition by July the 1st. I would like also to say one thing. I should have said something about this after my trip to Tennessee, which was for a Hillsdale thing. And we had like a huge crowd there because they just lifted some restrictions. So we had like 800 people in the room. And I don't think I've seen 800 people in last year, if you add them all up. And so to see 800 people in one room and then another 450 on standby, what struck me about that, though, is, you know, it's all merged now. The lockdown, the pandemic, climate change, wokeness. And what it all affords, of course, is opportunities for state control. That's what everybody has in common. When people say, "Well, I don't get what the LGBTQ activists have in common with the fire-breathing imams," because the one guys want to throw them off a roof, what they have in common is they both like control. And if you like control, then you're prepared to make common cause in the party that is most in favour of control. But I spoke there to Andy Ngo. You may have seen him. He's been on TV almost every night out on the streets of Portland and other American cities reporting on what Antifa are up to. And they beat him up and they did some permanent damage to him. That's not pleasant. The guy is basically had to live in hiding, had to move and live in hiding. And then I also spoke to Abigail Schrar, who's the author of this book, Irreversible Damage, which is about the transgender thing, and specifically about girls deciding they're boys. Because if you've been around showbiz as long as I have, you'll know that the whole transgender thing, you always met guys who wanted to be chicks. They wanted to, and that's, you know that. That's what 90% of the transgender movement was boys, men becoming women. And this whole phenomenon now of high school girls deciding they're boys is bizarre, has come out of nowhere in the last couple of years. And Abigail is one of the few people who's written about it, and as a result, Target, you know, caved to some wankers and banned her book and then reinstated it a little when they were portrayed as book banners. And Simon and Schuster are, you know, embarrassed at having agreed to publish the book. It all because half their interns, their woke interns, object to it. But these two, in their separate areas, both made the same point, that in their separate areas, the Antifa thuggery on the streets and the transgender madness, America is worse than anywhere else. And we're not just talking about worse than Hungary or Poland. We're not just talking about worse than continental Europe, like France or Germany, worse than Her Majesty's dominions, Canada, Britain, Australia, all the rest of it. And I think it's something that the virulence of the madness, the ferocity of the toxin starts in America and weakens slightly, when you get to London, and weakens a little bit further when you're in Paris, Berlin, Vienna, Rome, and is barely detectable then when you're in Budapest or Warsaw or Prague, this particular kind of nuttiness. And I'm interested in that. I'm interested in why what ought to be the strongest and the nation that's in the best position not to go over the cliff with countries whose moment of greatness passed decades, if not centuries ago, and why America is most drunk on this madness. And it's a most interesting question to me, and I don't quite know the answer to it, but I'd certainly be interested if anybody has their thoughts on it. At any rate, that's just an aside from me. We have George Prescott says, Mark, what do you think happened to Jason Kenney in Alberta? Isn't he supposed to be a conservative? The Calgary police barged in a Pastor Arthur's services for a second time without a warrant last week? Or is this a Nenshi vendetta? He's the mayor in Calgary. I think he used to be Ezra's flatmate at one time, many years ago. Jason Kenney was as conservative as Stephen Harper's ministry in Ottawa got. And then when the Conservatives were defeated, he ran for the leadership of the party in Alberta and became premier in Alberta. I think what's happened is that basically conservative government has been suspended around the world by this pandemic, and it's just a question, not by the pandemic, but by the particular political threads associated with it. And basically, you know, the theory of these people is, oh, don't worry. It's the same thing with Doug Ford in Ontario. The thing is, oh, don't worry. Once we've got the COVID under control, conservative government, small government is coming back. But until then, conservatives have to restrict your freedom of travel, restrict your freedom of association, restrict your freedom of speech, restrict your freedom of religion. And none of that works. None of that works. And it's particularly distressing to me. And I don't believe it for a moment. I don't believe it for a moment. And it would have been interesting, for example, in France, if, say, Marine Le Pen rather than Monsieur Macron had been in office in Paris, how much she would have done differently if she had been in power at the time. Winston Churchill, you know, Boris, for example, and you know my thoughts on Boris. The only thing I like about Boris is his plan to put the giant roundabout under the Irish Sea. It's the only thing that cheers me up with exits for England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales. It's not clear. Half the people in Ireland don't want an Irish exit. But anyway, that's the only thing I like about Boris. But the fact about Boris claimed to be the Churchill de nos jours. Churchill wrote to H.G. Wells, some of you may have heard Larry Arn talking about. He mentioned it. We'd actually been talking about it at dinner 10 minutes earlier, while I was doing this Hillsdale thing, wrote to H.G. Wells in 1904, objecting to Wells's idea that there were the group of experts who could rule the world according to their... He said, expert knowledge, Churchill did, is narrow knowledge, right? Like Fauci's knowledge. Fauci may know a lot about... He's been doing the same job since 1967. So he hasn't actually... There's been no midlife career change. He's been doing that job for 54 years. Same. Now, that's narrow knowledge. And government is not about narrow knowledge. Government, if you have the privilege of being a premier or a president or whatever... You govern generally. You have to take into account not just one little virological thread, but you have to take in millions of other threads that are connected to it. And that has all been lost in this rule by experts. And I think that's a tragedy. HB writes, Mark, as an imperial colonial monarchist type of fellow, perhaps you could comment on the situation in India. It's hard to tell if there are in fact people dying on the street or if the situation on the ground is not quite as the mainstream media would have us believe. Well, there's no doubt that deaths have taken off in India. They're still relatively low compared to deaths in Western nations 13 months ago. But, for example, I think yesterday they had 3,000 to 4,000 dead in India. It was a new record. They have an extraordinary... That's, by the way, in a country with a billion people. But it's overwhelming. We're getting the same kind of stories we're getting out of northern Italy, where there's more people dying than there are grave diggers to bury them. So the grave diggers are working around the clock. I would be... You know, we never... It's the post 9/11 squeamishness is now the model for all public health crises. So that after 9/11, that awful guy, I can't think of his name right now, and I don't want to think of his name because he was a nitwit. But when they brought in all the TSA procedures that are obliged to pretend that your 93-year-old grandma is as big a potential threat as the 23-year-old guy flying in from Sudan. And so this whole thing is fake. But they have to pretend, they have to universalize the thing. And if you notice, we've had the same approach here to a public, to the public health COVID thing. I would be interested to know in India, for example, you know, the Muslim women in particular don't get enough sunlight. They're kept in the house all day. And one of the things that wards off COVID and particularly wards off serious COVID, in other words, life-threatening COVID, in other words, a one-way ticket to the ICU and you ain't never coming out except by the handles kind of COVID, is vitamin D, whichever your preference is, from that big yellow ball in the sky. And that's something that a lot of Muslim women are deprived of because their husbands keep them inside all day long. So I would be interested, you know, there's no doubt that India is overstretched at the moment. It's all about data. Ron DeSantis said this, the thing. He wished he'd had more data back when he was having to make these snap decisions about, you know, 2 weeks to flatten the curve and everything last March. And what's fascinating is we ought to have tons and tons and tons of data now, and yet people like Fauci actually give us very few insights gleaned from the data, almost as if data gets in the way of the control freakery. Stanley R. writes, Mark, I first encountered you as the happy warrior. That was the title of my column in National Review. And in fact, some of you may have heard or read my deposition for the Michael Mann hockey stick trial, in which I was examined at great length by Mann's lawyer, John Williams, on what that particular title meant. And whether it was a position, whether it was an office that indicated I was employed by National Review, etc. Stanley says, I first encountered you as the happy warrior. Are you still? Please tell me how. Thanks. P.S. I love the club in all of its manifestations. Maybe that's the secret. You know something? I am basically, I mean, I think things are going to get an awful lot worse before they get better. An awful lot worse. And they didn't need to get that bad. But in the end, it's never, as I think I said before, it's never about a numbers game. It's never just a numbers game. It's about will. And one guy with will can overpower 1,000 people with no will. It's basically, you know, I think I mentioned this the other day in my review of the James Bond thing, Spectre. It's basically the last 20 minutes of every James Bond movie except Spectre, where he finds himself, or except Skyfall, I think it is, where he finds himself running around a hollowed-out volcano, Bond and the girl gunning down thousands of extras in those tinfoil suits driving those little golf carts around the hollowed-out volcano. And the fact that there's only Bond and the girl doesn't matter, because Bond and the girl are enough to take out the thousands of extras. And that's actually a good model for how these things go. Right now, the energy and the will is on their side. So that these stupid CEOs who don't really... The CEO, why would a CEO care about transgenderism or voter ID? He's got his business to run. These CEOs, some of them are committed ideologues, but most of them are just going along to get along. And they get the impression from Twitter, you know, they get 17 tweets and they think the world is coming down on them like a ton of bricks, and they don't realize. It's just, I mean, I can't, you know, in the end... whenever I guest host Tucker, for example, I get all this. Now that all the right went to Parler and then Parler shut down, and there's nobody, so there's no right wing guys on social media basically these days. There's just these lefties left on Twitter. So you would think if you just read the Twitter feed while I'm on Fox News for an hour that everybody hates me. And of course, it's not true. You know, I'm guest hosting for Tucker, and there's 3 million people watching it, and there's, you know, twerps with 2 followers denouncing me all hour long. But it gets back to that thing: who is the will? Who wants it more? The person who wins is the person who wants it more. This is why Afghanistan and Iraq and all the rest of it have been such a waste of time, because the Taliban, for example, figured out very early on that we didn't mean it. Yeah, we had all the money, we had all the equipment, we had the best trained guys on the planet, but we didn't mean it. And they did, which is why they're getting their crap hole country back. As I understand, Joe Biden's plan will be skedaddling out on September 11th just to tie it all together. The great admission of defeat is actually going to come on September 11th, just in case you like that day. Brian Hewson writes, hi, Mark. Hope you and yours all well, and all Mark Stein followers. What is your take on the 20-plus French generals writing on the demise of France? Yes, this is a collective letter. It's not just generals. I think there's 1,000 officers all in all, and they're not all retired officers. The head guy is 80 years old, and a lot of the other generals are getting up there in years. But, you know, that isn't such a big deal, is it? So he's 80. Yeah, you know, Joe Biden's going to be 80 at the time of next year's midterms, right? So just because he's an octogenarian, this general, doesn't mean that he can't weigh in on this. And these officers, and this has caused enormous turmoil in France, and it's made Monsieur Macron very upset, is that they've basically been providing a rationale for a military coup against the Islamization of the suburbs. As you know, in Paris, it's les banlieues. It's not you, if you're in downtown Paris. Now, if you're staying at the Georges Sank or whatever, you can still just about believe that Paris is Paris. But if you go in any direction, as I did a couple of years ago, I've done several times over the last 20 years, you begin to understand that there is this great seething, there are these seething banlieues where the writ of the French state no longer runs. And in fact, they regard it as being part of the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. And it is, Marine Le Pen did a little bit of political opportunism and said she welcomed these guys. She said, basically, the question here, no one can believe any longer the happy talk on this subject, because they know what the reality is. There's like French schools, primary schools, for example, that will not accept Jewish students. They've tried things like telling the Jewish students to pretend they're not Jewish. Now, you imagine how this is. You're 7, 8, or 9, and you've got to go to school every morning, and you've got to, you're a kid, and you've got to pretend you're not what you are. And then they realize even this stuff doesn't work, so better just not to have the Jewish kids here at all. I think this is, now, France is, in a sense, is not like, some of the other European countries in this respect. There is an aspect of the French military that thinks like this, that thinks they're like the Turkish military. They're the backup of the state. And that if things go wacky and some nutso government gets elected, then it is the duty, the oaths that these guys take to the French Republic requires them to protect the Republic from the people's choice. I would say one of the complicating factors, if you're looking forward to a military coup to save France from Islam, is that in my experience, when you encounter, particularly since the truck attack in Nice, when you've had military patrols in every city, military patrols as you board a train, military patrols as you go enter a supermarket, when you enter an indoor shopping mall, you know, one of those places where there's a building and there's like double doors, and then inside the building there's a fashion store and there's a supermarket and there's, you know, 12 other stores. And if you enter them, you've got to show your bags and have those bags examined by soldiers. And what was interesting to me in that summer of 2016, when I encountered all those soldiers in every French city, including on the nude beaches of Saint-Tropez, you had between the naked bodies, you had soldiers patrolling in camouflage, and not the desert camouflage, but the jungle camouflage, just so they stand out against all that nude flesh. What was interesting to me was how many of them were actually, one assumes, were Muslim, because those soldiers were North African in origin. And so, you know, you would have the idea that the French military is like a bastion of white supremacy and would be willing to lead a coup is not, in fact, it's the same thing in Belgium with the police officers who, there are a lot of high-ranking Muslim police officers. Now, it's the same thing in Britain. If you're wondering how Rotherham happened, it's basically that every girl who's being told by her daddy that she has to fly back to Mirpur in Pakistan to be married to a first cousin she's never met, if the little girl decides to go along to the constabulary and complain about that, her case will be handled by a diversity outreach officer who is in himself Muslim and generally alerts the parent to the father to what's going on. And that's the big problem there. That's that eventually, you know, people think, oh, the security forces, the dark Dick Cheney security forces will save us from multicultural. Well, no, they've just been hollowed out as much as anyway. Anyway, that's a very interesting question. Brian Hewson says. Holly says, Mark, do you believe it's possible to identify any benefits that Britain has gained from Brexit finally being accomplished, or has the madness of the China virus obliterated them? Your other question, I was going to save for a Mark Steyn show, but palace politics, it's about what happened in Jordan earlier this month as an attempted military coup against King Abdullah. King Abdullah is vulnerable in a way that his father wasn't. But we'll get into that. This business about Brexit, Holly, which is an interesting point. Basically, the vaccinization, the 95% herd immunity for residents of the United Kingdom over 65 versus the pathetic vaccine thing in France. And as I said, this is, you know, people don't like the vaccines, do like the vaccines. It's the Trump juice, as people call it. Hashtag Trump juice. Trump invented these things, as you know. Kamala Harris used to be scared that Trump was just mixing. She said she didn't want a Trump virus. He was just mixing it up. He was working in the lab late one night when his eyes beheld an eerie sight. It was the success of the Trump vaccine he'd been brewing in his Bunsen burner. And Kamala didn't want to take that vaccine. And then Trump goes away, and so suddenly now it's the Kamala vaccine, and all the people cheering on Trump's development of the vaccine are now saying they don't want to take it. But put all that aside. Put all that aside. And the thing about it is, in the UK, 95% herd immunity over 95. Now, you compare it in France, I think it's just 13% have got the vaccine. Been a failure of rollout, because it's European Union run. So it's been done as a kind of EU thing. So Germany, France, all of them, I think, with the exception of possibly Spain, have just got stinker vaccine things compared to the UK and such colonial sleepy colonies as Gibraltar. And one thing that's done, Holly, is that it's ended the Brexit. All the Ramoners, people who wanted to keep the Brexit debate going, this, maybe they will, but right now the stark contrast between on the vaccination front. Don't forget, this is from a liberal media perspective. This is from a Guardian BBC perspective. So in Guardian BBC terms, Boris is a triumph, and the EU is a huge mega flop. And I think, if you go back a year to how they were treated, the UK was basically the leper of the planet as far as the EU were concerned. You couldn't, you know, nobody wanted anyone from London or Glasgow or wherever going to continental Europe, entering the Schengen area. And now the UK has joined that privileged little group of countries because they've got a huge success story. And they'd be within their rights just saying, no, we don't want you diseased continentals coming anywhere near us. And that will, what will be interesting will be, obviously, Brexit, summed up by that Spectator cover 5 years ago, of the butterfly emerging and going out into the world. And that has not happened because the world is shut. For everyone except China, the world's shut down. But I don't think, you know, whatever the post-Brexit future would have been, right now, nobody's got any future except China and its allies. And so, but just in terms of domestic politics, I think in terms of Guardian, BBC whinging, the vaccine thing has put a stop to that. Michael J. from Colorado writes, Mark, receive my signed copy of The Green Fraud. Thanks. Yeah, we've been selling Mark Morano's excellent new book at the Steyn Online bookstore. You're perfectly happy. If you're getting the runaround from your local bookstore, well, we got it at the Stein Online bookstore and happy to mail it to you. As for today's Q&A, I'm focused on moving on. As painful as these last several months have been, and now the daily headlines coming from DC, there's no alternative than to focus on the 2022 House elections. The Democrats are a team that has the Republicans totally on the run, and unless the GOP goes on a fence in a big way, they will be toast next year. Trump was a result of their lack of fight against the destruction of Obama. I'm not convinced they have learned anything from the last 4 years. Your thoughts, please. Well, they're saying, you listen to McConnell and you listen to McCarthy, and they're saying, basically, everything that Biden is doing is so extreme that we just have to be the alternative to all the extremism, and we'll be back in 2022. Okay, now let's say, you know, that you're right, Michael, and that 2022 is everything. 2022 is everything. And it might even go the Republicans' way, and they'll control the House and they'll control the Senate. Then what? I mean, we had 2 years when the Republicans control the White House and the Senate. And what did we get to show for it? We got that crappo tax cut from Paul Ryan. Urgency. I'll say it again. I said it to the guys at the Hillsdale thing in Tennessee, in Nashville. Urgency. 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 You know, I had Newt on TV the other day, and I said to Newt, okay, just give me the big picture thing. I'd done a little thing on China. China's number one. How do we make America number one again? That's what I wanted Trump's thing to be. Make America number one again. Because Americans aren't psychologically suited to being number two. They're not. I don't think it sounds right, even. It sounds unnatural. So China's number one. How do we make America number one again? Take this wherever you want to go, Newt. And Newt was saying, well, you know, you look at it, in 2022, Kevin McCarthy is going to be Speaker of the House and Mitch McConnell is going to be Senate Majority Leader. Okay, well, we had all that in 2017, 2018, and they didn't do anything. And what I'm all about now, I'm interested in this. Newt's got a book coming out. Newt's got a book coming out called something like The Post-Biden World. He is a big, far-sighted thinker, and he's looking ahead to who's coming up in 2024 and what the Republican agenda ought to be for that. What it ought to be is urgent. We don't have this incrementalism, you know, oh, yes, we're going to tinker a bit here and we're going to tinker. No. When I say small issues, I don't mean like transgender sports, because that's a little bit of a hot potato. And my focus group guy has said it sounds like you're a bit of a hater if you say you don't want these 6'2" strapping, muscular thighs like tugboats, and then the most fabulous rack you've ever seen competing against your 5'4" little girl in the Connecticut State track events. I don't want to go anywhere near all that, because that's all too much a bit of a hot potato for me. Okay, fine. Unless you see the urgency about this. You know, it's not like when you're floating on the Niagara River in your canoe and you start to hear the roar of the falls. It's not time to say, well, let me just strum my ukulele for another 15 minutes and then I'll think about tacking for the shore. You should be tacking for a safe harbour from all this rubbish now. Eric Hoffer writes, Rush Limbaugh warned for years that the Democrats were simply done, fed up with concept of Democratic elections. We saw in 2020 what he meant. The dream that Trump could be re-elected in 2024 is just sad. The Democrats would not tolerate it, and the sky is blue. If some shred of American democracy is to be preserved, the Republicans have to find some way of mollifying the Democrats, who've effectively become corporatists, just another word for fascists, according to Mussolini. How, Mark Stein, our greatest thinker, how? Look, you're right. I didn't mention that in response to Michael, but the reality would be that, well, let's put it to, we have two things here. We have rigged polls and we have rigged elections. So what you see, what you'll have in 2022 is polls showing that the Democrats will retain the House and retain the Senate because they're all fake. The polls are fake. And then on election day, you will have the same kind of shenanigans in the same kind of cities that we had on November the 3rd, and the Democrats and the Senate will survive. Because America has fundamentally dishonest toilet elections. And again, the racial condescension, when you say, how do we turn this around? I think you have to start talking honestly about this. And I find the way Americans of left and right talk about the election process very bewildering. As I've said before, in that period between November the 3rd and Inauguration Day, I took tons of calls guest hosting for Rush on the subject. And the only time I ever felt I was talking to anyone who said anything that I would have been interested in saying was a South African guy in Florida and a Canadian lady in Illinois, because they were both saying just how nutso this system is. And I think we should, and I think it's not, again, it's not enough to waive the American Constitution and all the rest of it. We're talking here about elections, because it doesn't matter what the Constitution says, if the judges who interpret the Constitution are appointed by Democrats who are elected by stolen elections. And the fact is, this whole voter ID thing is absolutely absurdly condescending and racist. The Democrat Party was the most racist institution 100 years ago, was the most racist institution 200 years ago, and it's the most racist institution of black people. Oh, if you have to have voter ID, we've been talking about India, right? India, oh, look at India. They're being overwhelmed by the COVID. That can't be much of a country. No, but they got cleaner elections than filthy American elections. Everyone, over a billion people. You want to vote in an Indian election, you need your voter ID card. You want to vote in a Kenyan election, you want to vote in a Botswanan election, you want to vote in a Mauritius election, you got to have your voter ID card. Nobody does. Nobody says, oh, but wait a minute, Botswana, isn't that full of black people? They must be too stupid to get ID, just like they are in America. Well, oddly enough, Botswanans don't take kindly when you racist Democrats start talking your racist crap. And so I don't even know why we even get into the next stage of this conversation with people. The other thing is all this, now we're boasting, oh, well, look at Georgia under these proposals. Georgia has a way longer voting period than, say, Andrew Cuomo's New York does, or Joe Biden's Delaware does. You know, why is that a conservative argument? The reason it's called Election Day, because polls open at 7 in the morning and they close at 7 in the evening, so you've only got 12 hours to steal the election. And that's bloody difficult to do because of the concertina time. The minute you make it not 12 hours but 2 months voting period, anybody could steal an election. I could steal an election. I could be governor of Georgia. It's longer, in fact, than the entire campaign. See, I've made this point before. You have 6-week election campaigns in Canada, 6-week election campaigns in the UK, 6-week election campaigns in Australia. That's for vote. And then you vote on election day. And concertinaing it into 12 hours reduces theft and corruption. So these 2-month campaigns will ensure that Republicans are never elected to national office ever again. And people say, well, who cares? They're all white supremacists. We don't want them in the national legislature. Okay, well, in that case, why don't we argue it on the racism of you guys that in a society where you need ID for everything, I've been showing, I've done nothing today, but I've had to show ID 3 or 4 times just in my daily rounds in this control freak society. But as I said, Africa, India, wherever you go, there's nothing racist about requiring voter ID. There are literally billions of black and brown people who acquire voter ID to part of Belize, for example. They have voter ID. They have a much cleaner system, and they actually have to have, because in many Commonwealth countries, as you know, any of Her Majesty's subjects can vote. So if you're in Belize, a Canadian can vote, a Scotsman can vote, a New Zealander can vote, a Jamaican can vote. They managed to get voter ID to anybody from any Commonwealth country and run nice clean. It's a racket. We're not arguing. It's your racism. We don't need to get to what you're proposing, because it's all about using you guys. It's not even about the blacks. It's about all the people you're bringing into the country, and you're just making American blacks the fall guys for your racism, your filthy racism. I've never heard anything like it. And I accept I don't often comment on racial divide in American politics, because it's very different from other countries I've lived in terms of the history, the baggage, and all the rest of it. But this is the most filthy, dirty, disgusting, racist party on earth. To be arguing in 2021, the essence of the argument is that if you're black in Botswana, you're capable of getting a voter ID, but if you're black in Georgia, you're not capable. Screw off with your racism. Screw off with your racism. Let's see. Jeff Estes says, dear Mark, at what point will you consider running for public office? Well, Dana Perino was fully on board. At one point, I think it was the New York Post or somebody, was trying to get me to run for Senate in New Hampshire. And there was a mild little Mark Stein for Senate campaign. And Dana Perino got on board with it, and so did a few other prominent persons. But I don't know. As I said, I'm all about the urgency now, and I can't stand the lack of urgency from most Republicans. In the end, I may be driven to it. Who knows? Drew Weber writes, Mark, the policies of the Dems and the left are not only misguided, in many cases they are in stark conflict. Take Biden's goal to reduce the US carbon emissions by 50%. At the same time, they are championing mass immigration, both legal and illegal. A Pew Research study in 2008 projected U.S. population to grow from 296 million in 2005 to 438 million, 438 million by 2050. Now, the 300 million was reached in about 15 years ago, I think. In fact, exactly 15 years ago, I think, 2006. That's a huge... huge increase of 50% in a very short period. And as Drew Weber says, of which 82% of the increase, some 117 million, would be due to immigration. We can't have both drastic cuts in carbon emissions while bringing in millions of immigrants who would assume an American-style carbon footprint. Unless reducing our standard of living and hence our per capita carbon footprints is the plan. If so, what positive benefit to the American people will derive from mass immigration? Likely none. Yeah, this is true. I think there was some story in one of the newspapers, some columnists saying that first world people shouldn't have children on the grounds that somebody born in America or Britain or wherever has 18 times the carbon footprint of some kid born in Somalia. And that you could make that argument, but you have no credibility making that argument when at the same time you're bringing in everyone from Latin America and from Africa and from the Middle East to come to the United States and acquire an American-sized carbon footprint. So you take the kid in Somalia, who's all environmentally responsible and has a carbon footprint 18th the size of somebody in New Jersey, and you bring the Somali kid to New Jersey, where he acquires a New Jersey-sized carbon footprint. It's all bollocks, Drew. There's not meant to be any coherence about it. It's a straight power grab. You know, if you believe in big government, essentially you believe in you need a population that clings to big government as it would cling to its nurse. If America has 438 million people by 2050, in other words, an America with 500 million people, that is not going to be a first world country. You can forget about it. It's simply not. You know, if you're adding 117, where are the nice places going to be? If you're lucky, there'll be the places with, 4 million people, like Norway. But if you have 500 million people, of whom 82% of the increase that century is due to immigration, it will not be America. It's completely absurd. I'll go back to the argument people were making when the Duke of Edinburgh died, because there's a lot of people listening who don't like my monarchical inclinations, and that includes not just Americans, but some of our listeners in Canada and Australia who have Republican inclinations. The point about any society is that you need roots. And if you cut your roots, it's dangerous. It's dangerous for you and your children and whatever. Every society needs roots. You have to be planted. It's like you can't just have a society full of Christmas trees that you've taken out on January the 6th or whatever, and you just stick them into the soil as if they're real trees that are going to grow. They're not. They're going to stand there for a bit, and then a wind will blow them over, and they'll be lying on the ground. Every society needs roots. And you don't have any roots when you have mass immigration on the scale foreseen by that Pew Research study. You have, in fact, a recipe for one almighty civil war. Let's have one last question. Quinn Watson says, how do you think all this all plays out? The radical changes the left has managed to pull off in the last 15 months is chilling. We now have an administration that clearly despises the American people and even shows a disdain for their sycophants in the media who got them fraudulently elected. They are weak and incompetent, and everyone can see that. They walk around with two-thirds of their face covered with big black masks, which makes it easier for them to lie. It is so dystopian, this reality we are in, and I think people outside of just those of us in this club, I think even regular everyday don't pay attention to politics much. Joe Biden voters are starting to get a little worried about how things are playing out. I think there are a lot of Democrats out there who are perplexed at why their uneasy feeling got worse since Trump left office. I think there are people that are beginning to pine for the days when an off-color tweet was the worst thing they had to worry about. I think there's a general sense of malaise and unease that is setting in across America as we begin to see how America looks under this new regime. Your thoughts? Well, it's interesting to me the way we've seen just in the last few weeks. There are people, and I tried to talk about this with Naomi Wolf on Fox a week or two back, because Naomi was actually a celebrity on the left. She's the one who picked out earth tones for Al Gore to wear in his 2000 presidential campaign. So she's at the very highest level at the left, plugged in to, presidential candidates. And she's And I feel always feel sorry because there's a loneliness that creeps in. If you actually decide to, something makes, whatever it is, and in her case it's lockdown. She's figured out that normal life is never coming back and she wants normal life. And so she's trying to get this, and she says it's a bipartisan movement. And we all know that the only people who've taken up her proposals are actually on the right, and on the left she's becoming a pariah. And then we have Rose McGowan, who claims to have been raped by Harvey Weinstein and can't stand the hypocrisy of the Democrats on that kind, on that thing, where it's okay, Harvey Weinstein. Okay, there's too many women now. There's hundreds of women. We got to get that guy into jail. But when it's Hunter Biden with the child sex stuff on tape, or whether it's his dad groping, or suddenly all those, the credible accusations against people, certain other figures, no, suddenly we believe all women doesn't matter. And there's a slight trend. It's not quite a full-scale trend, you know. I've said just the last few weeks, Naomi Wolf, Rose McGowan, we really need a, in Fleet Street terms, we'd need a third for another prominent person to do this thing. But it's interesting to me that with both these people, they would have compelling reason to just go along with all the garbage and not find themselves isolated and excoriated on Twitter. But it's all about the urgency now. Urgency, urgency, urgency. Western civilization is sliding off the cliff, and America will take down everybody with it. And historians will excoriate the United States for being so foolish as to let Western civilization die on America's watch. Except, of course, that the historians will all be in Beijing, and there won't be really any such thing as a Western historian by the time all this thing shakes out. So it's about the urgency, the urgency. You know, America needs to clean itself up, get rid of the wokeness. We need a serious pushback again, not just saying, God, I used to get this on Rush. I'd mention these crazy trans stories. People say, why are you talking about that? Why don't you talk about the way you look at Ted Cruz is up 2 points in Iowa? So what? So what? You're in office and never in power, because you never fight on any of the turf that matters. Don't tell me, Tim Scott, wow, that was a terrific speech that Tim Scott made. Yeah, and today he met with George Floyd's family. Urgency, urgency. If you're not urgent about any of this stuff, you're not serious. So fine, win in 2022 and do something through all of 2023 and 2024. But win in 2022 and just put your feet up on the desk of the Speaker's office, like that guy who's now in prison did. I pass. Not enough. Urgency. It's all about the urgency. This has been Mark Stein. We're approaching the fourth birthday of the Mark Stein Club. That's next week, I think. This weekend we have music and movies and Mark Stein's Passing Parade, the adaptation of which I hope you're enjoying, and I hope you enjoyed Andrew Lawton's guest hostings. I can't believe it. I've guest hosted for Rush and for Tucker and for various other people, and now at last I've got my own guest host. And how pathetic is that for Andrew Lawton? He's basically the guest host for the guest host. Is there anything more pitiful and degrading than that? Well, we'll leave that question for another day. Thank you for all your queries. Some of the ones we didn't get to, we'll try. And sorry if I got a little bit angry. That's because I made the mistake. I flew on into Nashville and I was rebuked by the stewardess, or whatever you're meant to call them now, for not replacing my mask on my face between sips of my complimentary plastic cup of water. You're meant to take, remove your mask, take a sip, then put your mask back, then take another sip. And I deplorably had taken a sip of the water, put it down on the table, and then taken another sip of water and left too long an interval between replacing my mask. So that's made me, I've made the mistake of flying internally within the United States, and it's put me in an awfully bad mood. Anyway, thank you for all your questions, and we'll try to get some of the ones I didn't get to today in the days ahead, and we will see you next time.